Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, November 30th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. And soon we will be having a chat with a very interesting, unique, passionate, and brilliant woman. But before we do, I just want to get through a little bit of business. And maybe those of you who stick around and listen to the business will be pleasantly rewarded. First, I want to thank those of you who have supported the show this week. Specifically, I want to thank Todd Erickson via the PayPal portal, and I want to thank Elena Scott, Phil Tebear, Timothy Glover, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell, who have visited the show at patreon.com/talknerdy and pledged to support the show that way. I also want to thank the many, many more of you who support the show week after week, whose names I simply can't read because it would take too long. I also want to remind you that there are a lot of other ways to support Talk Nerdy to keep it 100% free to download for everybody who's interested. The first is just to tell your friends and family about it, you know, talk about it on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, or you can rate or review on iTunes and Stitcher. Another way to support the show is to visit carasantamaria.com and see all of the different options there. Now, one of the kind of, I think, more fun ways to support the show is to shop in the Talk Nerdy store. And I will tell you that sales have been slow. So I want to shake things up a bit. I am going to open up a holiday promotion. If you visit carasantamaria.com and you use the offer code NERDYHOLIDAY, you will get 15% off of your entire purchase. And I will also throw in a free goodie with every purchase that's provided by one of the friends or sponsors of Talk Nerdy. So don't miss it, you guys. This is your chance if you've been waiting to get a t-shirt that you like or that really beautiful handmade mug that I have for sale or just, you know, a nice gift for yourself or for friends or family. So go ahead, visit the store. It's at carasantamaria.com. Click on the store link and put in the offer code NERDYHOLIDAY for 15% off and a free gift. Okay, guys, without any further ado, I am really excited to welcome this week's guest. She is the master of disaster herself. She is geophysicist and science writer, Mika McKinnon. Mika, thank you so much for joining me for the second time today, because we had some crashy crashes, which happens sometimes when you record audio. It's fun.
Keeps things exciting.
It keeps things exciting. It helps us get to know each other just that much better.
Exactly. It's warm up. It's rehearsal time.
Yeah. So for those who are just tuning in, which is all of you except for Mika and myself, Mika is a scientist who is also a science communicator, who is also a consultant, and does a lot of really cool work with television and film, doing consulting to ensure that the science fiction, the fantasy stories, you know, just get a little bit of science know-how in them.
Yes.
Is that, would you say that's right?
Absolutely. It's totally fun. And getting to play with science.
Getting to play with science. And what are some of the projects that you've been able to consult on?
So the one that I'm allowed to talk about that most people have heard of is Stargate. So I worked on Stargate Atlantis and Stargate Universe, and I got to hang out on set. If you've seen those shows, you have seen my handwriting. It's amazing the number of my friends who've been like, that handwriting looks weirdly familiar. I may or may not be a science consultant for Sharknado, and I genuinely don't know. Which I think says a lot about the film industry right there.
Yeah, what does that even mean?
So once upon a time, I got a call from Asylum Studios saying, hey, would you please tell us about tornadoes? And I said, sure. Although given the type of films you make, are you finding this out just so you know what not to do? Because Asylum Films, like, their huge thing is like, hey, let's, you know, have a whole bunch of colored beakers filled with fluids in order to measure length. Like, they take it all and make it absurd. So why are they asking me about the mechanics of tornadoes? So I did. And a production cycle later, Sharknado pops out.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I go, did I work on that? I don't know. And I don't know if I should be proud or horrified if I did. So that's...
And also, how much money should you be collecting from this?
Well, so I've met a bunch of other science consultants over the years, and I have figured out one very important feature that differentiates science consulting in Vancouver versus the rest of the world, which is in Vancouver, we get paid.
Yeah, that's good.
It's a
that's
job.
Necessary.
And I do it. Yeah. And it works even if I'm in Vancouver and consulting with people in LA or New York or anything like that. It's a job, and we have money exchanged, although no credits. One day it's so the rules of IMDb are that you need to have one credited thing before you get credits for all the uncredited stuff. So I desperately want to have like a walk-on role somewhere or like one of those vanity credits, anything. So I get my first credited thing so I can get all the things I've worked on that my name never appears anywhere in them.
That's so crazy that there's no credit for science consulting.
We don't have a union.
So
credits,
that makes me so sad.
Credits are huge currency in the film industry, and I'm totally fine with that, because it's the writers, the producers, the actors, they will talk about the work that science consultants do, and I am totally friends with the people that I've worked with, and I've done panels with them at conventions, and it's not like they have me as a dirty little secret hiding in the back of the closet. It's just that credits are how they've a hugely unionized, carefully laid out thing of who gets it for what and under what circumstances and what the titles are and all of that. And science consultants
it's a big part of what you
don't exist in that.
It's a big part of what you negotiate at the top of a show, other than fee and you know, all of the stipulations around your fee and the kind of creature comforts. But that's true. It is important that you're credited with the appropriate title, you know, based on what you actually did.
Yeah.
You don't want to be undercredited, and you don't, well, a lot of people actually want an inflated title, but it's probably not good to have an inflated title. But it's sad that that's not a common practice, because it doesn't seem like it would be that hard to do to ensure that the people who, you know, do the science consulting actually have their name in that list of like 400 people at the end of a movie or a TV show.
It only really annoys me when you have like production babies listed and you're like, but
yeah.
I was actually on set. And it's totally different than, so I'm also a geophysicist, and geophysics is a highly regulated profession to the point where, as a Canadian geoscientist, I actually wear a little pinky ring that says that I have joined the secret occult order of geophysicists and that I'm legally entitled to work. We have things legislated in, like our minimum pay for particular jobs. You may not pay us less than this, and we are ethically bound to not accept pay below this, or we can be stripped of our license to practice.
Holy crap, I didn't know that. I don't know if that's the case here in the States.
Well, engineering and geoscientists are regulated in the United States, but they don't get the special pinky ring. That's a purely Canadian thing. It's engineers get the iron ring, and then depending on your province, Canadians get the silver ring if they're a geoscientist, and I was so proud when I got my ring.
Yeah, this I learned from Derek Muller from Veritasium, because he wears the pinky ring because he's Canadian and also Australian. Well, he's actually Canadian, but he studied also in Australia. Do they do the rings in Australia, or was that from a Canadian degree that he got? Cool. It's such a funny thing that, like, I love it, though. I think it's neat. You know, we get class rings in the States, and I think class rings happen in other places, but they're sort of optional, and if you want one, you can get one. But it does seem like it's a real point of pride for engineers, and they wear them all the time.
And it's you do like the little wave across the room where you specifically have your pinky finger a bit farther out, or you like clink with other people. It's definitely been, I'm also a big ballroom dancer, and it's totally funny on the dance floor and then suddenly having the pinky rings clink and then being like, wait, what? What sort of geoscientist are you? Like, I found one. So
ballroom dancing big among engineers in Canada?
It's normally a physicist thing. It's actually, I started because I was part of the UC Santa Barbara ballroom dancing physicists. And most of...
Shut up. That's a thing?
It's a thing. It was, of my class of 25, 22 of them did at least one day of ballroom dance. And over 20 of them did like an entire semester of it. And at least a handful kept going and did competition level and everything else. But it makes perfect sense because you've got this class where mine, I actually had great gender proportions relative to physics in that we had four women in my class. And then the rest
in
are
a class
guys.
Of 25. Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. So that, isn't that sad that that's actually a good proportion?
It was amazing.
It's better than none.
Well, and if you looked at the physics class for both, I was in the College of Creative Studies. If you also looked at the bigger physics class over in Letters and Science, so we're talking about out of 200 people, there were fewer than a dozen. So,
yeah.
But so you have these huge gender disparity happening there, and that, you know, who are you going to ask on dates except for the people who you see all the time? So the girls kept getting asked out, and some of them say yes. And for me, I found it kind of annoying. because I didn't like the whole concept of dating inside my class. So by yeah. going to ballroom dance, first of all, we're in a situation where there's 200 women and 30 guys. And you're like, oh, I am not outnumbered for once. And second, yeah. they're all interacting with all these other women who aren't the four in their class. And so many of them met their wives in that class. It was amazing. And that there is not just... they are meeting these other people, but it's forced one-to-one social interactions with physical contact. Like, that's what social dancing is that you have to learn manners as part of it and courtesy and how to physically interact with each other without it being a big deal, which is not always normal among the geek community.
Physicists. Like, yeah, no, especially, I think, you know, we joke about it, but there definitely is kind of a continuum. And we do see that when we talk about, you know, I think we throw around the term a little bit willy-nilly, which is kind of unfair about being, quote, on the spectrum. And really, I think what we're often talking about is the fact that there are probably more individuals with Asperger's or at least social anxiety disorders within the physical sciences, maybe diagnosed, maybe undiagnosed, but I'm not sure. Do
not
you think
having
that it's
experience
a...
as well. Like if you're the nerdy kid who loves numbers, you might not be the popular one in high school because culturally speaking, we're going to beat up on you. If you like math, it's not necessarily been a popular sort of concept. So then
yeah,
you get
true.
To university and you haven't necessarily had a whole bunch of social interactions, and then you're in more classes with a bunch of other people with the same problem, and nobody really knows how to break it. Or if they do, it's kind of the standout thing. So by just being like, screw it, everybody's taking ballroom dancing. Everybody, you're a physicist, you're taking ballroom dancing. Just dealt with that problem so well. And it's a tradition that's been continuing at Santa Barbara for the last 10 years or something. It's fantastic.
That's really cool. I think it's so great when you see this combination of arts and sciences. I think there's a big kind of misunderstanding that scientists' work is not at all creative and that scientists don't have a creative aspect of their brain. I think it comes out of bad, you know, pseudo-journalism talking about the difference between the right brain and left brain. And
yeah, like, I openly acknowledge that I am very much a physical sciences and I find... the squishy science is challenging. Like if you can poke it and it squeaks or moves or anything else, I don't understand. It's not challenging. I don't get it. It smells funny and it's squiggled. Like I don't understand. So it's not my realm of things that I ever write or talk about really, except for when cute animals are involved because cute animals are always my beat. Sharks. Sharks are totally my beat now. I went and visited a shark just so I could say that.
Wait, so you think sharks are cute?
Oh, yeah. They're adorable. Okay. Like, I just went out with the Why Sharks Matter, Dave Schifrin and his crew out mm-hmm. in the shark tagging group in Miami. And we went around for a day with high school kids doing shark outreach where they were learning how to catch a shark and then tag it and measure it and take all this scientific data and then send the shark out. And I got to pet a nurse shark and it was amazing.
And it was adorable?
It was fantastically cute. It was this super sweet little animal. Well, gigantic animal, bigger than I am. And instead of feeling like sandpaper like most sharks do, it feels like you would imagine that a reptile felt like if you've never actually seen one in real life. Like,
oh, like it would be almost slimy?
Yeah, like it was this pebbly, mosaic-y, slimy sort of textured skin where I'm like, are you wet pebbles? I don't understand. Aww. I just pet it for a couple of seconds and I was like, you're probably stressed out and want to go home. You can go now. It's okay. So yes, sharks are
but
my
other
beat.
Than that, so that is your foray into biology.
Yes.
Other than that, squishy
yes.
sciences.
Yes. So
scary
this whole
you.
Concept of like talking about what human brains are good at and this and that and the other, I'm just like, I don't have the science to debunk this, but that doesn't make
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, I can tell you it's bullshit. Like, it's bullshit. Yeah.
For personal experience.
Or this idea that we're lateralized, yeah. that somehow we're if you use your left brain a lot, your right brain suffers, and vice versa. It's like, what the fuck? We use both sides of our brains.
Or the whole concept of you only use 10% of your brain. You're like, really? Because optimizing to just have this huge chunk that we carry around for no reason and makes childbirth more difficult. Yeah, totally a thing that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, we don't use 100% of our brains at the same time. That's like a horrible seizure. But beyond that.
Yeah, well, again, you want a max capacity out on everything all the time. That, again, is not efficient. Like, just think about
that's
how
when smoke starts coming
out
of your ears.
As, like, lazy as possible and still succeed in doing things. And that's probably a good enough answer. And that's how I understand biology is like, what's the laziest option?
I think that's a good understanding. It really is. It's how do we maximize efficiency, minimize the amount of energy that we're putting into the system. And that's why we have, I was just talking about this on Skeptics Guide. That's why we have all of these redundant systems. And that's why we have, we were talking about homeostasis, how we have all of these things in place that help maintain a system to a very tight degree, because it's important that we actually maximize that kind of efficiency, because generally speaking, in order for us to have energy, we have to eat shit.
It have to be successful slackers. It's
Because we don't get to make our own food like some cool organisms do.
Oh, that'd be so much fun. Like that is
right. Wouldn't it be cool if humans photosynthesize?
One of my favorite things about writing for IO9 is, so I write for IO9 mostly about space science, but I'm like slowly stealing other beats. That was part of the visiting the sharks with being like, well, we need somebody to write about animals. I visited a shark, therefore I'm the shark expert, right? It's a totally logical sort of conclusion. So, you know, if you have cute animals for me to visit, go ahead, let me know. I will come and pet them. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to kill me if I pet them, then I'll just stand there with my hands behind my back, ooing and aahing. The great thing about writing for IO9 is that we totally get to go off on these crazy sci-fi what-if futurism speculation things. And it's what we're supposed to do. Where it's like, yeah, there's the science reporting, but there's also the, like, what if humans photosynthesize? Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, this is how it might work if we could.
What color would we be? Where would we have all this sort of thing happening? What if we were more like mushrooms? We just kind of, like, found something and went... Like, I have no idea what mushrooms do to get energy, but this seems like they have to have something awesome going on.
But they eat dead things. I don't want to... Well, I guess we eat dead things too, but we cook them first.
Sometimes.
I do. I always do.
No raw veggies for you?
Oh, yeah. I guess those are dead things. Damn it. Yeah. You got me.
Yeah.
I don't eat raw fish. I don't eat any fish. So no raw animals.
All right.
But you're right. I do love
raw fish. As a geologist, I do occasionally eat rocks.
Of course you do.
But hey, everybody else does too. They eat salt. Salt's a mineral. Come on.
That's true. That's true. And sometimes pregnant ladies actually crave dirt.
All sorts of minerals. All sorts of things. Although if you're going to eat dirt, make sure you bake it in your oven first to decontaminate it. I just got back from Ecuador a little while ago, and the customs people gave me so much grief because I brought back all of these rocks. But I'm like, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Bake them all first. They're like, okay, you can keep them.
Yeah, they're like, I have no idea what that means, but whatever.
I scrubbed all the dirt off
You're
and then I baked them and now there's no bacteria. I promise.
It's funny because I have a handful of like very small fossils who a paleontologist on a story about the business of bones, about whether or not, you know, private collecting is okay and the ethics involved, assured me that the small fossils that I have, like trilobites and things, are okay for me to own. But between those and a meteorite that I have that that my wonderful boyfriend gave me for Christmas last year, all of my friends always want to lick them.
Well, with a fossil, it actually makes sense because one of the ways you ID fossils in the field is you lick it and if your tongue gets stuck to it, it's an old bone.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, not like permanently stuck, like, or even like as stuck as with ice or something like that. It's not like out of a Christmas story, but it is definitely, you just look at it and you're like, oh yeah, this is probably a fossil. Awesome.
Yeah, you're so right, because paleontologists, when they start really geeking out about bones, and I've interviewed enough to know this, they're all about talking about their taste and their smell.
Oh yeah.
Like, these are really important components for them to understand, you know, the difference between the bone and the matrix around it and kind of maybe how old it is or, you know, where it came from, the type of bone that it was in. But the meteorite thing, I think people just want to have their tongue next to something that was in space.
Yes, although there's also maybe the hope of getting that gunpowder taste happening.
Oh, yeah, that can happen. And also it's really cold, you know, it's like cold and heavy and just kind of cool and otherworldly, which is fun. Yeah. But so you have like a beautiful rock collection at this point,
oh,
I'm assuming.
Yeah. I am an addict. I've got a lot of rocks.
So tell me, explain to me, because this was a phenomenon like what, in the 60s or the 70s, or maybe it was earlier than that, the whole pet rock phenomenon, which I fully don't understand. Explain to me what it is about rocks that you're so enamored with.
Well, I definitely do not have pet rocks. I have a pet hedgehog who, having like a sentient cactus running around being grumpy, is more than enough for me.
That's so cute. Is he so cute, though?
He is adorable, and he hates the entire world, but he hates me least of all, and that's good enough. Yeah. And he sulks if I'm away too long. I'm like, all right, all right. And it probably says a lot about me that at one point I calculated out his running distance compared to a human. So first of all, I quantify his running every night. I have a little odometer on his wheel to see how far he runs. And he runs like 6 to 9 kilometers every single night. And one night...
Oh my God, and he's so small.
He's got half-inch legs. And one night he went 13 kilometers and I went, okay, this is ridiculous. So I did a footstep comparison. So I talked to an ethologist about like gait length and things like that for how he's moving when he's running. And went, okay, so the number of footsteps he ran is probably this many. And then I compared that to a human about how many footsteps a human would have covered. This is the hedgehog equivalent of running 2.5 marathons back to back in less than a couple of hours.
What?
Yeah. I'm like, I have been out-fitnessed by a hedgehog. I will never keep up with him.
By a hedgehog in a cage?
Yeah. Yeah.
So wait, I'm going to ask you a squishy biology question then, because I don't know much about hedgehogs. I know that they're like porcupines.
Not at all related, though. Like, not even vaguely
not
related.
So we think of them as being like, that was my question. Yeah. Do they have actual quills that they can disconnect?
No. So they have quills, and the quills are made of the same stuff as fingernails. And they shed their quills like you'd shed hair, but they don't, like, they don't come off in you. Like, petting a relaxed hedgehog is a bit like petting a hairbrush.
Gotcha.
Petting an angry hedgehog is like petting a cactus with various degrees of like hypodermic needle action happening. I'd like,
but you wouldn't see, like, you've seen all of these memes of like dog versus porcupine.
No, that would not
happen. If it was dog versus hedgehog, he wouldn't have all those quills in his face.
No.
Okay. That's good. So they're a little, I mean, it sounds like he still could be dangerous, but less dangerous.
Really, the way he would be dangerous is if my home was invaded, I stuck my hedgehog in a sock and like beat them with it. That would be like unhappy for the hedgehog and for the intruder. So really, he's just a very small, angry cactus that runs around.
It's like a little Brillo pad.
Yeah.
I love pictures of baby hedgehogs.
Oh, man. I got this guy when he was 6 weeks old. It was the cutest thing in the world.
So,
and he's
cute.
Just gotten massive since then. Massive being under a pound.
And also can run multiple marathons.
Yeah, he's got like a little hourglass underneath his quills. I'm like, this is ridiculous.
That's so crazy. And what do they eat? They probably just eat, like, what's hedgehog food?
So hedgehog food is actually carcinogenic for hedgehogs, proving that people will buy anything if you put a picture of their pet on it.
Oh, my God.
So
what do you actually feed them?
Yeah, so ideally you feed them dog food because it's got the right sort of nutritional balance happening on. But dog kibble is way too big for a hedgehog. So either you chop it up, which, because I am an obsessive pet parent, I definitely do. Or you do cat kibble, which I also mix in there. So he mostly eats that. Some people do raw diets and try and figure things out, but they're exotic pets, so they're not exactly well-studied. They've only been around about 50 years as pets. So, like, my little guy is so tame, he would die in the wilderness, aside from the fact that in Canada he'd freeze to death. But
he probably wouldn't do very well in
he
Canada.
He does not have the reaction time to be able to protect his spiny little butt.
And so they're carnivorous, or I guess omnivorous?
So
I never thought about
that. They kind of fulfill the ecological niche of a rat.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, they for sure eat.
Yeah, they eat all sorts of things. He loves mealworms more than anything else in the entire universe. Mealworms are just, like, the best way to bribe my hedgehog. I have heard of hedgehogs who eat eggs, and in Africa, they will also occasionally... They do this thing called anointing, which is just crazy. They find something that smells amazing, and they go, ah, that smells good. I should smell like that. And they lick it like crazy and build up this frothy spit and then spread it all over themselves and, like, contort like the world's most awkward cat trying to reach their own backs. And you find out, like, their tongue is ridiculously long when they're doing this. And at the end
of
it...
And what do they think smells amazing?
Well, my little guy has anointed with various instrument cases on the assumption, I suppose, that instruments are the most prized items in the houses I've lived in, therefore you should smell like an instrument. He's done it with a carrot and dyed himself orange in the process.
Aww.
He has done it with a potato chip, and I had a Lay's scented hedgehog, and he smelled exactly like a potato chip. And I was like, I actually can't give you a bath. You worked too hard for this. Like,
that's adorable. I want my dog to smell like potato chip.
And then most recently, he's found one of my friends where every time he meets my friend, he's like, I need to smell like you, and just goes crazy. And the friend is starting to get kind of smug about it, being like, yeah, uh-huh, I am hedgehog bait.
So they kind of, it's personal for them. Like, they have their own personalities. They like specific smells.
Yeah, there are some hedgehogs that go crazy over cilantro and then dye themselves green. I love this because they're already a fairly punk rock pet because they're so spiky. And then they dye themselves like manic panic colors. And you're like, wow. All right.
That's amazing. You should see if playing like the Dead Kennedys makes them run faster.
So in, you know, one of the things they do in the wild is they'll do this with poison frogs and then like coat themselves in poison. And you're like, you're spiky and poisonous. Great. Great.
Oh, that's so brilliant. Oh, so it really does have adaptive purposes to it. It's not just about, like, I want to smell this way, but I want to
either... they're, like,
either...
freaking immune to every poison on the planet. They'll do it with turpentine. They'll do it with cigarettes. Like, they're crazy.
I have a friend whose dog, when we go on hikes, she has a little Pomeranian, and every time it finds something dead on a hike, like a dead, you know, frog or a dead
snake... It's just, like, rolling it.
Yeah, it rolls around in it. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I'm grateful my little hedgehog appears to like things that smell better.
Yeah, and my dog has no interest in rolling around in dead things. Yeah. It's a very odd behavior. Squishy things are hard, aren't they?
they're so confusing and individual. So confusing. And I'm just like, I don't get it. I just don't
get
it.
But see, I feel the same way about what you study, which is why I think it's fascinating when I get to talk to people who have expertise in fields that scare me. Like, I studied squishy things, right? I studied the brain in school. I first was psychology and philosophy, then I was neuroscience. And I have a passion for paleontology, if you can't tell, because of dinosaur tattoos and dinosaur collections, and I talk about dinosaurs all the time. But when I first found out that most people who become paleontologists actually are geology minors first, it turned me off. Like, I was afraid, or I was, I didn't understand it, or there was something about studying rocks and old dust and earth that made me go, I don't know if I want to put my effort and attention into that. Yet, for you, you thought rocks, dirt, dusty things, I love it. I want to throw myself in.
Well,
what is that difference? What is so exciting to
you? I would say that, so one of the things I do when I talk to high school kids about what do you want to do next, and they're talking about going to school of some form, I go, okay, so if you're doing, you know, you want to do humanities and you don't know what you should do, take a philosophy class. And if you know you want to do science and you don't want to know what you want to do, take a physics class, because both of these will teach you how to solve problems. And like, by themselves, they may or may not be useful depending on what exactly you want to do with them, but they will never be a detriment to learn how to think about and how to solve problems, and then add on whatever specializations that catch your interest as time goes on. So I'm a geophysicist. I started off in physics, and then I went, ooh, pretty, and wandered off to rocks. And I started by, I watched a lot of Star Trek when I was younger.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
You said that, like, you should be ashamed.
You know, just, like, obsessive amounts of Star Trek. And so I was interested in space, but I have the world's worst vision. And I am allergic to, like, everything on the planet, and otherwise just should never leave Earth. Like, I shouldn't do it. It's a bad idea. So I went...
Well, hey, you're allergic to everything on the planet.
I know!
Maybe you'd be great off the planet.
There's no bees there. It'll be great.
Yeah. There's no grass.
I'm allergic to penguins. Who's allergic to penguins, and who knows they're allergic to penguins?
That makes me so happy you have no idea.
I've got the cat allergies and the dog allergies and the grass and the dust and the pollen and the bees with the whole kill me aspect of it. But penguins, that's just not fair. So was really interested in everything off the planet, but allergic to things and going like, I'm just generally a bad candidate for an astronaut. So, hey, let's just study the things instead. Oh, hey, if you're studying stuff in space, you get a choice. You either do light and astronomy, which is all spectra, or you do rocks. And places we've sent things in the fairly recent past or will in the relatively recent future, or even occasionally like Mars, have a robot running around on right now. And I went, ah, data that isn't light. Okay, cool. I'm going to do those ones. So I worked on planets, and they picked inside the solar system is geophysics, outside the solar system is astrophysics. It's a weird distinction in planetary science. So I was a geophysicist.
Oh, okay. So both of those are considered planetary science. There's just geo versus
astro, like if you're doing
if it's Earth or other.
And it's because it's the type of problems you're solving. Like if you're doing exoplanets at the moment, all we have is light from it and that spectra analysis. And that turns out is what you do in astrophysics for all sorts of different things. So you end up in the astrophysics departments. And if you're looking at rocks, you're going to use the same tools as geology and geomorphology and thermodynamics and all of that. So you're going to end up in the geology departments.
Yeah, it's kind of like I think we see this in even biology or neuroscience, where before you can kind of understand what we would call pathology, you need to understand the normal human functioning.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm interested in brain damage. I have to understand how the brain should work before I can understand what happens when something goes wrong. And it's probably very similar that you have to understand the state of things on Earth before you can start trying to understand what's different outside of Earth.
It's so cool. We're currently sending a rover to the very, very first time to visit an active dune on another planet. And we're doing it like this week. It's awesome.
Oh, shut up. Where? What? Tell me all about it.
So the Curiosity rover is currently making its close approach to the Bagnol dune fields in Gale Crater. So we've watched them from space for a while. They are black sand dunes made from basalt that's been all crumbled up over time. And we know they're active because we've seen them move in satellite images over the air, where they've moved up to like a meter a year, just like, dunes over here now. So we have a pretty good understanding of dunes here on Earth. It's all wind flow and grain size and all sorts of things that we think we understand. But it turns out every time we look at something on another planet that we thought we understood here on Earth, we learned out we're not the only version of it. Things can be quite different. Like, the physics is the same, but the geology is different, and we might find out all sorts of crazy cool things. We don't know. We've never done it. We're about to. So.
Yeah, because they have a different atmosphere, and they have different, you know, they have all these
different
parameters.
Weathering processes, because they don't have life. It turns out life really does a number on rocks. Like,
oh, interesting.
So there's this really cool concept that the number of minerals we've had here on Earth has increased over time. So minerals are the basic building blocks of rocks. It's like the equivalent of talking about elements, where you're like, oh yeah, so here's these particular crystalline structures that have a very distinct chemical composition, not necessarily a fixed one, because you can substitute in other elements that behave the same way on an atomic structure, but they're crystals are minerals-ish. There's so many geologists in the audience right now who are just like, no, but
you're helping me. Yeah. You're helping me.
I'm telling like little white lies here. It's okay. We'll roll with it. So like salt is a mineral.
Okay. And like quartz,
yeah,
is a mineral.
Exactly. But sugar wouldn't be, because it's although it's a crystal with a definite composition, it's not exactly, it doesn't follow the same atomic structure when it builds up each time. So sugar, not a mineral, but salt is. Ice, water ice is a mineral.
Okay.
So in the beginning of the Earth, we only had a handful of minerals, and then we started having things happen. And each of these stages that happened, we got more and more and more minerals. And the one that things went absolutely crazy on is we got life, and life created an oxygen atmosphere during the Great Oxygen Catastrophe. And from this, there is an explosion in the types of minerals happening and the complexity of minerals happening. And there are even biological things that create minerals. There's this little extremophile that eats arsenic and poops gold. That's crazy.
That's amazing.
So all these things shouldn't happen on places that we don't have life. Like, there's some minerals that should not exist on Mars, that we've never found on Mars, and we never expect to find on Mars, because it hasn't had that same past. So if you're talking about a planet that has a different mineralogical makeup than ours, where it literally has different building blocks for all of its rocks than ours, and some of them overlap, like there's olivine there, the stuff that's like pistachio green mineral, there's a beach on Hawaii that's famous for having it, or having like the hornblendes, which are the shiny black ones when you look at granite, things like that. They've got those too. And we don't know what happens when you have sand dunes that only have some minerals in them. We think we understand, but we won't know until Curiosity walks up, takes a sample, looks at it and says, here's what I've got in my little tiny scooper paw. And then it's going to scrape its little wheel on the side and be like, scoot over, sand, let's see what's underneath, in order to look under. And it's just so exciting.
And then we, back here on Earth, get to look at that data and learn a lot from it, which is so cool.
Yeah.
It's so crazy how far away it is and how it's like actively doing science all the time.
Oh, yeah. I'm so, so excited. We have the next one launching is going to be a geophysicist. So we've had a lot of geologists on other planets. We've sent a bunch of robotic geologists and gone like, hey, go crack open those rocks for us. And could you lick it? Like, robotically lick it. It'll be good. But we're sending our first geophysicist, and I'm a geophysicist, so I'm so excited for this, where it's going to do seismic sensing. So it's going to actually listen for earthquakes on Mars, and it's going to do a heat flow probe, which is Well, I've screwed up a lot of heat flow probes, so I hope they have better luck than me, but they're going to hammer it like 6 meters into the Martian surface. So it's going to be our first like actual, we are going beyond the top inch of surface and going down into the planet and seeing what is happening and how is heat flowing? It's actually a fairly self-explanatory probe. It looks at how does heat flow and how does that change over time? And I'm just like, that is so exciting.
I love your energy for the subjects that are so interesting to you, especially considering that this is not anymore your day job. I mean, your day job is to be excited and to help people understand why things are exciting, but you're not actively doing, or are you actively doing geophysics now?
I wear my ring, which is very important to me as I'm licensed. I'm allowed to do geophysics. But the science that I do as a day job now is all disaster research. And it's primarily in a translation position where I go, here's what the science says. And I teach that science to policymakers so they can come up with better ideas on how to keep people from dying.
Oh, interesting.
So things like a tsunami is more than one wave.
Yeah.
If you don't know that, you're really going to plan much, much differently than if you do know that. Mm. So it's all these things that aren't necessarily very complicated science, but that I have that knowledge that they don't necessarily have because it's not their world. Why would they learn this? And teach them enough so that they can come up with better plans on how to keep people from dying. So that's pretty much the only place that I am as a scientist working.
Other than
or working as a scientist,
broad science communication, like writing and doing other kind of consulting with media outlets.
Yes.
But so you've said, I mean, I've heard you say you have a master in disaster,
which I love.
So that is really that the core stuff that you learned in geophysics really translates into this idea of disaster science, right?
Yes. So geophysics is this really bizarre field. There are not many geophysicists, and it's the concept of you are up here at the surface and you want to know what's under the surface without actually going there because it's complicated and expensive to actually like drill holes or dig mines or whatever else. Mm-hmm. So instead, you do something to create some sort of signal, and then you have sensors that see how it propagates, how it shows back up on the other side, and then go, okay, I know how it started. I know how it ended. What happened in the middle?
Yeah.
So it's all inversion science where you have the answer. What is the question?
Interesting. It's very Jeopardy.
Yeah, it's very Jeopardy or possibly Hitchhiker's Guide. I've never really decided which. And it's also something where anytime you come up with an interpretation, there is no such thing as a unique answer. It's all inversion science. It's all potential methods inversion science, which means that just mathematically, you can throw a constant of integration on the end and have it all just be equivalent to each other. So you can't come up with the right answer. You can come up with likely answers or different scenarios. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully somebody's willing to pay for a drill hole to go down and check and be like, yes, it's right in this one spot. So probably the whole model is like ground truthing it. Or sometimes they never check and you're like, oh, I hope I was right.
One day you'll know.
Yeah. Well, and at the same time, it's this really incredibly powerful tool where we do things like we've used earthquakes to find out what the core structure is for the Earth, where we're going, there's a solid inner core, there's a liquid outer core. Like, we know this because of geophysics.
That's always really fascinated me when I'm working as a science communicator and I'm talking about a new story in the news that is interesting and I'm trying to break it down. Oftentimes, especially when it comes to these sort of planetary science questions, I'm always amazed by how scientists can infer things that almost seem like they have nothing to do with the data collection about the world. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, well, because of this earthquake, we were able to measure the amount of, you know, shifting and whatever, and that can tell us about the core composition of the Earth. Like, that's insane to me.
The thing that I find really, really weird is there's a field of science called geodetics, and it sounds like the most boring job in the world, where it's, what is the shape of our planet? You're like, it's a sphere. Yeah. Moving on. But it's not. It's this weird, lumpy, mishapen, horrid-looking thing where it's like, it turns out the continental crust is less dense than oceanic crust, so when you have huge mountain ranges, they're actually less dense. So gravity is weaker. Huh. So if you do like a pendulum next to Mount Everest, it actually deflects away a little bit.
Interesting.
Like, what? Like, that is not my intuition there. So if you start doing geodetic models of the Earth, they're all weird and lumpy and mishappen. And then you're like, okay, fine. So you do that and you do it once and you're like, there's the shape of the planet. But that isn't enough because plate tectonics are moving at like the same rate your fingernails grow. So every time you clip your nails, think that like, oh, the Pacific Ocean has gotten that much closer to North America. Oh,
that's weird. So weird.
Like, oh, I love it.
It's so weird that we, because I think of the way that we evolved, right? I'm coming back to squishy sciences.
Yeah.
Because of the way that we evolved to understand small things as being small and big things as being big, and things that are so small we can't see them with our eyes are really hard for us to understand, and things that are so big we can't measure them with our, you know, the width of our arms are hard to understand. The idea that things that we think of as being fixed are actually very dynamic is such a wonderful finding in a lot of fields of science. It's so wonderfully surprising and so uncomfortably true for us. You know what I mean?
Oh, it's amazing. And it's amazing to me that in disaster science, a lot of what we talk about is the timescales on which energy builds up and then the timescales on which it releases.
Yeah.
So like an earthquake, the timescale on which energy builds up is the rate your fingernails are growing. That's how much the plates are moving together. They get locked. They get stuck. They start deforming and buckling. So like Vancouver Island off the coast of British Columbia is actually uplifting and tall right now. When we eventually have our earthquake, all that built up energy over the last 300 years is going to slam all out at the same 60, 90 seconds, maybe 120 seconds of vigorous shaking. And the entire island will slam down and out. Like, what? It will displace by meters when it releases. Geez. And it's just like, what?
I can't even fathom that.
It's lower afterwards. And then you talk about other things like the disasters that are happening from climate change, that's building up over a long time and that's releasing over a long time. Like a hurricane builds up its energy over a couple of days or a couple of weeks, and then it releases its energy over a couple of days. And then climate change takes that to an even bigger extreme.
Yeah.
And you're going like, oh man, like no wonder we're terrible at understanding this.
And you know, it's funny.
Like, we're going to have shifting baselines. We're going to have all sorts of conflating other issues happening. We're going to have complex interactions and it's on crazy huge timescales. There's no hope of actually trying to wrap your brain around that in an intuitive manner. You have to just logic it out.
Yeah, and you have to have these big, complicated models. And they're all like parameters, you know, they're error bars. It's like, it could be this bad, it could be that bad. There's
the way I've always seen it is, you know, I don't like uncontrolled, unplanned experiments. Mm-hmm. Like, as a scientist, they morally offend me. You should have a plan when you do an experiment, and you should have a clear set of data you are trying to collect. And we are currently doing an unplanned, uncontrolled experiment on the only planet that we can live on. And that just seems like a really bad idea.
And all the data we collect kind of says, ooh, this is not going well.
No.
Or like, we should probably make some changes. It's true, but you're right. For like the everyday person who's looking, you know, you have one experience and then you try to sort of extrapolate what that means for the overall effect. And it's really difficult to do because that's not what the science is doing. The scientists as a whole are looking at these massive models, these huge algorithms that allow for all sorts of different variables and trying to predict something that's almost bigger than us. In many ways.
And it is. And it's going to be complicated results because this planet is not homogeneous already. Like, we've got cold bits, we've got hot bits, we've got dry bits, we've got wet bits, all of that. And you're just going to crank up extremes. So, like, yeah, it's going to get hotter and drier in Australia, but it's going to get colder and wetter where I am.
Yeah.
So does that mean it's not happening?
That's like, true. That really throws a lot of people off.
I'm sorry.
Understanding
I'm
that there's
kind of happy having more rain than less rain. Like, if you're going to have to pick between the two, I think I picked the right location.
Yeah, we didn't.
But
I didn't in LA.
At the same time, I'm going to have a lot more landslides to deal with my baby young volcanic mountains that have all their toes chopped off by glaciers and are already ridiculously oversteepened. Just add more rain and then shake them with a few earthquakes. So it'll be great.
Yeah, it's like people don't understand, or we have a hard time understanding, that there are cyclical things that are going to happen regardless, because there are all these different systems that are closed systems that are operating within this one giant closed system. So you have, you know, seasonal things. You have things that happen on these random cyclical, maybe not random, but on these prescribed cyclical timescales. And then you have what we think of as accelerated, something that's being accelerated that should be happening on a geologic timescale that we're accelerating to happen on sort of a human timescale.
Yeah, it's not pretty. It's not pretty, and I'm not looking forward to it. And I'm already not enjoying all the extreme weather events. Extreme weather is my least favorite disaster.
That's so funny, because we think of, I think of disasters as almost all being extreme weather. I think of tornadoes, I think of hurricanes. And again, it could be, I say again, we talked about this before, we had an audio fuck up. It could be because I grew up in Texas. And in Texas, when I think of extreme weather, I think of hail and thunderstorms and being hot one day and cold the next day and wind and tornadoes.
Yeah.
Like, that's disaster for Texas.
Whereas I am hardcore West Coast. I've moved 27 times up and down the West Coast, never more than 5 minutes from the Pacific Ocean. I can see a volcano from my window. And I live in earthquake country from when I was but a wee lass up until now. And I'm always near mountains that landslide down periodically. It's, those are my disasters. I understand them.
Gotcha. So it really has a lot to do with what you know to your level of comfort. The idea of a landslide scares the shit out of me.
Oh, the landslides are like deeply and painfully understudied. It is one of the things that makes me fairly sad, because so we had that big landslide out in Washington 2 years ago now, I guess, Steelhead landslide, or the Oso landslide. And there are all these people after us being like, why did they build a town at the bottom of that? And I wanted to just be like, do you have any idea how to recognize an unstable landslide? Because I can promise you, the USGS does not have enough people to go around and tell you where they all are. And landslide maps are not really a thing that happen on a generic basis. You have to go looking.
Like, yeah, that's a bummer. Like, when
there's no money for this. They are so desperately underfunded. And then in Canada, it gets even worse, because we had this like war on science happening. So we don't actually even have a landslide scientist employed in Western Canada at any level of government. The closest one is in Alberta.
Are you serious?
He retired in February of 2014.
Oh my God. So you don't have anybody who is advising the federal government about anything happening on the whole west side of this country with regards to landslides?
And we're building a pipeline through the Rocky Mountains. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine.
Christ. But there's hope on the horizon, right? I mean, I've been seeing Twitter losing their shit in excitement about Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, we have a minister of science again, which is pretty exciting. And we're going to have a census again, so we can actually measure what's happening. We haven't had a census in a long time.
That's weird.
Which is, it's been fun, because either you say, oh, nothing has changed, we'll just use the old numbers. Or you say, well, we're effectively American anyway, we'll just use theirs and ignore that we just apparently had like a 4,000% population increase. Whatever.
I'm sure it'll translate over.
It'll be fine.
Basically the same country.
There's been all sorts of, like, the last decade has been so hard. There's been closing of the science libraries, like, literally taking the libraries and throwing them in the dumpster.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no exaggeration, dude. Just books into the dumpsters.
Oh, God.
And there's been the muzzling of the scientists so you can't talk to them. And, you know, the fact they're in the public service apparently means they aren't allowed to tell the public about science, which is just, I don't understand on any level how that can be a thing.
Well, and it's also like deeply unnerving to those of us who work in science communication, whose like number one driving force is helping the public understand science.
Oh, yeah. And you can't actually interview Canadian government scientists about their work. And you're like, okay, I guess I'll go to the USGS to talk about that earthquake in Victoria. Like, what? And then there was the attrition rate. So when scientists would retire, we wouldn't hire new ones. So, for example, I work for Natural Resources Canada sometimes. And when I do, I have a 15th floor corner office for 15 days a year that I share with nobody.
Oh my God.
That's wrong. That's, like, that is so deeply, I should be in a little cubicle somewhere, like, doing a desk share with people.
Yeah, like, it's really wasteful is what it is. It's like some of the resources are actually there and they're just not being utilized.
Yeah, so I desperately hope that we will see a change. There's already been, like, a lot of the low-hanging fruit has already been grabbed, which I'm very grateful for. Like, they've announced we're having a census. Yes!
What are some other things that you're excited about, like, that you think might actually happen?
And they're unmuzzling the scientists. Like, each department is doing it. I'm really optimistic about the climate summit happening in Paris this week. Mm-hmm. To start with, they've invited members of the opposition parties to go. So Elizabeth May of the Green Party has been invited to actually attend this year. Last time she had to go as a delegate for another country.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it was bad. And we've changed the name of the environment portfolio to be the environment and climate change portfolio, thus acknowledging that climate change is a thing.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful that as we change those sorts of things, it will get better. I'm hoping, really, really would love if we started monitoring more of our lakes again. We just decided to be like, oh, it's too small. Who cares if you pollute there, was one of the joyous things that happened in the last decade. We also killed a bunch of long-term research projects that nonprofit organizations took on for themselves that I hope now get some support again. Mm-hmm. I really desperately hope we do a big hiring spree because we've lost so much institutional knowledge and we're losing capacity in our federal government because we are unwilling to take people on as public servants. And if you want to work for the public's benefit and you're good and competent, then please, I wish we would hire them.
Do you have a system? I mean, I'm not really sure I fully understand how the university system works in Canada as opposed to in America. Here in the States, obviously, we have both public and private institutions. And if you work for a public institution, in effect, you are still in service to the federal government because you are basically paid by tax money. Do you have the same kind of system where there are both public and private institutions of higher education?
We do. It is nowhere near the same sort of economic distance between the two.
Oh.
We just don't have that many universities and we don't have that much population.
Yeah.
So when I came back to Canada, I'd done my undergrad in the United States and I came back to Canada for grad school. I literally applied to every single university in Canada that had a planetary sciences department or program, pardon me, not even department, program, and more than 4,000 students. And I applied to all of them and it was fewer than a dozen.
Wow. I couldn't even list. I would have no idea where to start with how many universities there are here.
Yeah,
that's a massive difference.
We do a ranking of all of them every year in the Maclean's magazine. And it's a fairly short, it's not like a big, huge, it's a normal magazine size.
Mm-hmm.
And we do different rankings on all sorts of different, it all fits.
That's
it's a small country.
I think that's cool. That excites me that I would have that kind of knowledge ahead of time and that I could make such an informed decision instead of being overwhelmed by too many choices.
It has been really interesting in that Canada and the United States have this strange dynamic where Canada is an awesome country and I love it, but we're very, very small and don't have that many resources. So you can have a lot of impact, but at the same time, you can only get so far because there's only so many people and so much money available. Or you can cross the border in the United States. There's more competition. There's more human beings. And there's more funding and there's more opportunities and there's a bigger population. So it becomes easier to do things like be involved in the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a strange dynamic. And there's definitely years of brain drain of everybody who's finishes their education and then goes into the United States to work for their productive years and then come back to retire. And that can be problematic for our tax issues. Or at the moment, hopefully we're getting a little bit of we have some opportunity and hope in this country right now. Maybe you can work here in our benefit.
Well, and
so we'll see how that goes.
That's good. I mean, I'm glad to see that. I think some of those ceilings are going to be lifted because, there is a lot of opportunity here, but we struggle with very similar, except on, a different scale issues. And I like the idea of free exchange of information between what I often think of as a sister country to us. It's funny, growing up in the United States and only visiting Canada for work, I've never lived in Canada, so I think we have some preconceived notions and we have the things that we make fun of Canadians for and vice versa, I'm sure.
I leave the house and go out and about now, eh?
Yeah. what's really funny is people always think I'm from Canada by the way that I talk, which is so weird to me because I'm a Texan. It's super
weird. Oh, I have
weird.
The hybrid Canadian and Californian accent. So I have my leave the house and go out and about now, but I also have my and banana.
and banana. Shabra.
And I do the like.
Yeah. No. And I feel like that has bastardized. It has worked its way into even other cultures and other countries. But, we make fun of maple syrup and milk in a bag and all that good stuff. But outside of that, we do think of...
and our potato chips. I mean, come on. Oh, we have every possible flavor of potato chip.
You have all dressed.
We have everything.
You have
you want
ketchup.
Smoked maple syrup? We've got smoked maple syrup.
So weird. Ketchup flavored chips is the weirdest thing in the world to me.
It's I'm actually both a Canadian and American citizen. I'm a hybrid, and I go back and forth across the border at will. And what gets me is how hard it is for individuals and how easy it is for companies. Like, something simple, like paying my credit card bill. You'd think this would be easy. It's so hard. Like, I have U.S. funds. I am paid by Americans in American currency with an American bank account. But I can't actually have a U.S. credit card because I'm not currently resident in the United States, even though I have a U.S. address. So I can only get my U.S. credit cards in Canada, which don't accept payments from American banks. And you're like, oh my God, I am so certain that Xerox does not have to deal with this.
Oh my God, that sounds so like, complicated. I've definitely...
It's a nightmare. Don't be a human being, be a company.
Yeah, I've seen the same thing happen with, I mentioned Derek Mueller, Veritasi. He's been on the show before. He also has the pinky ring. And he has struggled with a lot of that. I think he just finally got his green card. And so he no longer has to be on a special work visa, but now is able to just like act as though he can do whatever here in the States. But I definitely remember a lot of complaints about just frustrating things with getting payments and getting access to bank accounts. And what a nightmare it is.
And
it's weird because it's like you're basically, I think of it, we're all North American.
We have NAFTA. You're allowed to work in both countries. We just had this huge influx of animators come up in the last like 6 months in Vancouver. So Vancouver, we film all sci-fi here. Like if it's sci-fi, odds are it films in Vancouver. And we're trying to build up our visual effects industry. So we've been giving them all sorts of tax rebates and things like that, which means a bunch of companies have been opening up here recently, which means a bunch of animators have all been like crossing the border from the United States. And we're collecting them all. And you can find like groups of them at pubs and be like, it's the animator expat collection. All right.
That's exciting, though. So you said that a lot of sci-fi is filmed in Vancouver. Was Stargate filmed there? So were you able to be on set when you were consulting?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's my handwriting is all over set. If you see Atlantis or Universe, you have seen my handwriting. What's really funny is when I get like handwriting samples from actors and have to learn how to mimic theirs or get told I can't use certain characters because they can't handle that particular Greek alphabet. Like, I understand, like, nobody can write squiggle. Like, it's just, it's impossible. But like Lambda, come on, everybody can do Lambda.
Yeah, Delta's pretty easy.
Yeah, so there'd be some that I'd have restricted alphabets for. But I loved working on Stargate in part because the cast and crew were so curious. Like they genuinely wanted to know things. And there was one time I got into a wee bit of trouble because one of the actors asked me about the beginning and end of the universe. And it turned out I had a chunk of one of the boards I was working on was about the beginning and end of the universe. So we were like standing in front of it and I was doing the excited flailing of like the 60 second history of the universe and how we knew what shape it was and how we thought it was going to end and what data we were collecting about it. And like, and he's asking questions and turns out we were holding up filming. After that, I learned how to give the 30 second history of the universe.
There you go. They could wait 30 seconds. I mean,
yeah,
it is the beginning and the end of the universe. It's pretty important.
Exactly. And what I mean, it was particularly fantastic. Just that particular whiteboard was, or chalkboard at that particular one was used because we had to have characters, two science characters arguing about a thing. And it didn't matter what they were arguing about. Like it was off plot where they'd finished the plot related things and were just like screwing around having an intellectual debate. Mm. And the debate was, how do you think the universe is going to end? And the actors learned enough to be like, my character would side on this side for these scientific reasons.
That's so wonderful. That must have been so heartwarming when you heard, you're like, oh my God, you're so right.
Yep. So David Hewitt and David Blue, absolutely hardcore geeks. If you were ever wondering, they really are in real life. Total sweethearts.
David
and
Blue.
Hardcore
He's a friend
geeks.
Of mine. He's out here in LA now.
Yep.
Oh, and he's so Canadian, isn't he? Or is he not? I think he
is.
He's
actually. American, but he worked up here.
Oh, well, he picked up a lot of Canadian while he was up there, rubbed off.
That's because we're the best. We're
you
the
know,
best.
It's funny. You mentioned this thing about like, you know, this argument was off plot. Sometimes arguments are on plot. And that's one thing that I think we haven't had a chance to talk about. And I think it'd be fun to end the show talking about this idea of, you know, science consulting in film and television. And there are two different camps of people that I find. And just as a quick background here, I mentioned SciComm Camp, which was this wonderful science communication retreat that I put together with some colleagues of mine. And Mika, you came and you taught one of the writing workshops with Jennifer Ouellette, who's also a previous guest on the show. And one of the fun things that we did on during SciComm Camp is we had a science in the media, science, and actually more just science in entertainment, so in nonfiction programming, panel. And one of the people that we had on that panel was Zach Stentz, who is a writer. He wrote for Thor. He wrote for, what else did he write for? I think some X-Men movies, and, you know, very well known and really into this kind of sci-fi fantasy genre that utilizes a lot of science. So that's the backstory. There was this great panel. It raised a lot of questions. And I noticed that the audience felt very split. I noticed that some young science communicators were really pushing for this idea of the science comes first. You should write the story around the science. I'm in a different camp. I think that you're in a different camp because we have more understanding of the way that Hollywood works. And that camp is that the science should be in service to the story.
Oh, yeah. And I don't even actually see it as a conflict. So one of my favorite moments. So I'd worked for Stargate long enough to build up trust with them. Like in the beginning, it was like, go write your equations in the background. Don't touch anything. Behave.
Yeah.
But over time, we talked and they found that I was definitely a highly enthusiastic scientist who was like, oh, you need that? Sure. Let's find a way to make it happen. And they came to me and said, we need an astronomical big baddie that kills everybody every 22 minutes.
Huh.
And we're thinking of having it be a very slow pulsar. And I went, ooh. So if you have a pulsar that slowly, rotating that slowly, it's going to be about as deadly as if you take some fridge magnets and start doing cartwheels. Like, that's not going to generate much of a magnetic field. You're not going to murder anybody with that. But how about instead we have a little binary system with a pulsar that's right on the boundary between being pulsing and not, like just on the mass boundary, and a feeder star, and they're rotating around each other. And as that gas giant gets too close, some of the gas gets like sucked in and it activates the pulsar for a couple of seconds. And yeah, sure, technically you're getting like hundreds of pulses in just a couple of seconds, but on screen it just looks like a little wave of death. And then the orbit continues around and is gone again for the next 22 minutes. And here we've solved the problem. It's this complicated science backstory that is mostly in the equations and makes it into the dialogue in like a sentence of dialogue. So highly simplified. Mm-hmm. And it's something we've never seen in real life. Like, there is no observational evidence that this type of system exists. But there's no reason it couldn't exist.
It's plausible, whereas the first idea wasn't.
Yeah, and so we've kept the exact same consequences. We've changed one line of dialogue, and we've created something that you're no longer using up your plausibility on it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you can do that with a lot of science. Like, okay, fine, time travel. Time travel is not a thing we've seen. We don't really understand why time only works in one direction, but in our experience, it only does. Mm-hmm. But there's a bunch of science that says, okay, it could happen. And if it could happen, it might look like this. And it doesn't bother me to go into that realm. It's like, sure, why not? Just all I ask is try and pick a flavor of it that you just constantly stick with. Like, pick a specific type of wormhole or a specific type of interpretation of time travel and try and be consistent in that so that you're seeing the consequences of it play out instead of constantly shifting and being like, well, here it's this type and here it's this type and here it's this type and hey, all those rules, just throw them out. Because that also makes for bad storytelling. Like, yeah, it's bad science and bad storytelling.
Yeah, because to me that's lazy, and that also requires that the viewer try and follow what seems like an arbitrary plot. Whereas if I can suspend disbelief about one or two core things and say, okay, I'll give you that. But then if everything else is consistent and has continuity, it'll be easier for me as a viewer to fall into a sci-fi plot line.
Oh, yeah. It's the what if. Just tell me what my what ifs are and I will work with those.
Mm-hmm. I like that. So really, your approach when you go to work with a big production is to say, I'm here to help you make the science as good as it can be in service to the plot that you have already identified is important.
Oh, yeah. And it's particularly fun because a lot of times it's teaching people about this practice of science and this culture of science and these interconnected ideas that they wouldn't have thought of. It's anybody can Google things or read them on Wikipedia or anything like that. It's knowing what to look for. That's why you'd have a scientist. Is you go, okay, I'm going to have something in a desert setting. And you might think of looking up, like, what sort of, where you're going to find water in it. Mm-hmm. But you might not think about that sand dunes sing.
Hmm.
That sand dunes, because they're tiny little grains of the same size, and as you move them around, they sing. And how about that for being a way of, like, when you're trying to sneak around, you can't because the dune is giving you away.
Oh, yeah, I would never think of that. I would think of them as being silent.
like you get these little quirks of things happening, or that you have the temperature extremes happening of the super hots and the super colds, because nobody ever said that a desert had to be hot. It just has to be dry.
Yeah.
Or how catastrophic rain is in the desert. You think, oh, it's a lifesaver. But then you look at what happens when you have rain in the Death Valley and that you have flash flooding happening and everything coming down from the hills. Oh, and what would be the geological markers that could foreshadow that? The types of landforms you would see that say our heroes have picked a terrible place and things are going to go awfully wrong for them in the near future that you wouldn't necessarily pick up on. But if you're a geoscientist, you'd be like, you couldn't have flash flooding there. You could only have it here, over there. So it's adding that chunk of plausibility or adding that context you wouldn't otherwise think about.
And that's why it's so important both to serve the plot, but also for, I think, visual interest, you know, so that when people watch something, yeah, maybe not everybody will know that, but it must be helpful even for the directors and the producers when they're first working with the set designers so that they're not starting from scratch. They're starting from story and utilizing the expertise of a science advisor to say, what would that really look like? I mean, it's already painted for you in your mind.
Yeah, it's totally fun to do that, or to be able to do things where you're leaving Easter eggs for people. So I found that science consulting as a job on set, as opposed to a novelty, has been getting more and more popular. And I think the reason for that is because we're valuing science more in our stories. And that's happening in part because of Freeze Frame and the internet forum.
Yeah.
That people can take a picture of it, put it online, and collectively obsess over every single detail in it. And it turns out scientists are a really cheap way, a very economical way of adding richness to that. So I've had people who contact me, I've had school teachers contact me asking for photos of some of the sets that I worked on, saying, can you give me unobstructed views, unlike what you can actually see in the show, because I'm going to set this as a challenge to my students. And it's so much fun to be able to then take somebody's passion for a show, for an idea, for a character, and use as your jumping off point to go, okay, you are absolutely, completely in love with Doctor Who. Let's talk about how our perceptions of cosmology have changed the types of stories that happen in Doctor Who.
And how much fun for the kids, you know, how much fun for an individual who's trying to learn to be able to actually have a jumping off point from popular culture, from something that matters to them, instead of just this out of whole cloth, arbitrary, you know, numbers or letters.
Yeah. I love that. It's so much more fun.
It is. It's fun.
And it means that we're not always using like football as an example. It turns into like, then you're starting to get into something where you have inherent gendered bias happening inside of the sorts of stories you tell. Because you never see examples about knitting.
No.
And knitting requires a huge amount of math. Like,
gender
bias.
The
amount of algebra
science?
Required in changing gauges? Like, man.
That's so true. Yeah, that's definitely true. But come on, gender bias in science.
No,
that's a thing. Are you serious?
Oh, it's one of those things where, like, I try not to very often talk about, like, flat out about gender issues in science when I'm doing mentoring things, unless I'm directly asked about it. But it's totally, in fieldwork, it's like going back to the freaking 40 years time travel into the hillbillies to find out what's going on.
It's the same way in media. I'm sure you've seen that when you've been on set. I mean, granted, Stargate, I think, was very different because there were a lot of strong female characters and it was really treated differently. It set an example.
I also had the world's greatest boss at Stargate and I had some great mentors, and overall, everybody was very excited to have a scientist. They'd play a game called Stump the Scientist where they'd hear I was coming on set for a particular day and they'd like go read the news the night before and find science stories and be like, so what about aerodynamics of dragonflies?
Oh God.
Or there was one day on set where I didn't know this until I showed up. I showed up and the person who's leading me around on set that day tucks me in behind them and leads me up to a group of people and then shoves me out and goes, we have a scientist, and pushes me forward. And it's Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bill Nye the Science Guy. And they flap their hands at me and go on, science at them.
Oh no.
So I'm like, how about those perchlorates on Mars? So like, being a scientist is definitely being an other, where it's neither male nor female, you're other.
Yeah, that definitely happens when you're the only one. But in the science community and then also in the media community. And I mean, we talk about this all the time on the show, but we're still struggling with gender equity for sure.
I have yet to go a week without a death or a rape threat since I started working as a science writer.
Ugh.
I'm waiting for that 1 week and it's going to be like that. Yeah. And there's definitely some articles I write and then hit publish on it. I'm like, I need a bottle of wine to deal with this comment section.
Yeah. Like you know ahead of time. And then there are other things that seem so innocuous and you're like, why? What?
Like, yeah. Why did that blow up?
Exactly.
I don't understand.
Like, what possessed you to think that thing, like to be offended by this innocuous thing that I wrote that
I'm
now you're coming
flat
back?
Flat earthers. Yeah. I didn't know flat earthers were still a thing, but
oh,
they are.
Yeah, they're like organized too. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, like climate change ones, I understand. Women in science ones, I hate, but I understand.
Yeah, it's
but
like you can
flat
think of the
earthers
big ones,
are
like abortion,
me.
Climate change, vaccines, things like that. But yeah, sometimes it's
perpetual
something as simple
motion?
As like, yeah, the earth is round. Oh shit, I don't want to offend anybody.
Oh, I don't mind about offending people at this point. It's one of the beautiful things about writing for IO9 and Gizmodo is that we are required to be opinionated.
Yeah, which is great. And that's really, I think, where a lot of those distinctions within SciComm and SciJourno really do exist. And I think it's always wonderful to have outlets, even if you do work as a science journalist, to have outlets where you can flex that muscle a little bit.
Yes.
Because it can be really frustrating when all you're doing is straight reporting all the time. I have outlets where I do straight reporting and I have outlets where I can definitely have an opinion like this,
yeah.
Obviously.
And yeah, I definitely there are some stories I won't write without opinions. Like I will not deal with the NASA's impossible drive where you're like, okay, no, just no.
Yeah.
Just no, just no, just no.
That
do you
was
need me to write
one.
About this again? Is this news? This isn't news.
But let's write about it again, like every new news cycle. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a
and here
one.
Are the things that need to be fixed before this is an actual legitimate test. Oh, you don't want to give me your data? That's not science.
Well, on that note, that's not science. So much is science. And I had so much fun talking to you about science. Before we go, I have my final two questions that I ask every single person who comes on the show. And I want to see what you have to say about them.
All right.
Also, can flex that opinion muscle. So the first one's depressing and the second one's uplifting, if you so choose to answer them that way. The first question being, when you think about the future, you know, in whatever context is meaningful to you, what are you most concerned about? What keeps you up most at night? What worries you the most? And on the flip side of that, what are you, you know, wholly excited about and optimistic about?
Oh, that second one's so much easier to answer. So I am concerned about a rejection of rational thought. I really get worried when I see people value not using science-based policy and science-based opinions.
Mm-hmm.
That I think that there is science does not solve all problems. It does not fix everything. But I think that there is a huge value in using data to make large-scale policy decisions. And it concerns me when that isn't happening. And it really concerns me when it becomes a political hot point to declare that you do not want to use science and data-driven policy.
So yeah, welcome to America.
Welcome to everywhere, right?
It's so
like that's happening all sorts of places. And the upside is sometimes there's pushback.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the reasons I do so much science communication is by changing what our cultural perceptions are of science. Maybe we'll find it friendlier and welcoming again. Like maybe we'll find value in it again.
Yeah.
So things I'm looking forward to is I'm looking forward to the robotic geologist on Mars. I'm really looking forward to the next NASA Discovery mission, especially if we pick Venus for it, because, wow, we have not gone to that planet in a long time, and it's about time we spent some energy on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited that New Horizons is going to go visit a second object way out there on the edges of the solar system. I desperately hope we decide to fund it so it actually, you know, keeps the scientists in coffee and computers long enough to see what it sees when it gets out there.
So what's the subject now? First it was Pluto. Where else?
It's going to MU69, I think.
So another Kuiper belt object?
Yeah, it's going to be a second really, really tiny one. And it actually got discovered while New Horizons was en route to finding it. So unless the discoverer, who is it's in his nice and early ages, unless he has a horrible catastrophic accident, it'll be like the first time the person who discovered the object gets to send an explorer to it inside their lifetime.
That's freaking crazy that's the time we live in.
Yeah, like I don't want to jinx the poor guy by listing his name and all that. Like nobody go run him down. Like keep him alive for a couple of years so he can see this.
Ah, so cool.
I hope he has a long and fruitful life and doesn't like immediately die the day after discovering or sending the probe
there.
But
at least then maybe he'd be happy.
Yeah, and I'm excited for all the data coming down from Pluto. I mean, like, freaking every Thursday we're getting new data dumped on us, and it's going to happen for another full year. And it's just amazing the things we've been learning.
I know, just those images, right, of like the three images of Pluto side by side, of like Pluto in 2015, Pluto in like 2009 or something, and then Pluto in like 19 whatever. And just, it you know, it's like pixelated light. It's so crazy.
It has fog and blue skies and fresh ice that is younger than the Rocky Mountains.
Wow.
Like, that is totally unbelievably cool. And I am really, really excited for when we send our next lander to Mars. We're going to launch it later this year. In the next couple of days, we're going to have a shot at... So there was a Japanese space probe that was supposed to go in orbit around Venus, and it had salt clog up its valve, and it missed and went flinging off into space, and it was really, really sad. Mm-hmm. They've come up with this crazy plan where on December 6th, I think it is, they're going to try and slip into orbit in Venus again by using its attitude control jet. So by using its steering mechanism, it's going to burn them for 20 minutes, which is way beyond design parameters.
Yeah.
And if it works, we'll get a new orbiter around Venus, which right now it's a planet with nothing there.
Like, cool. So it sounds like they're sciencing the shit out of this orbiter.
I hope so. I really hope it works. I mean, it might not, but I hope it does. And we've got asteroid return missions coming. We've got so much cool science happening in planetary. And I really, there we go. If I'm going to be super optimistic about the future, I'll be like, oh yeah, all of this interest in science and how successful the Pluto mission was in getting media attention and how much we loved The Martian as a movie. Maybe we will up NASA's budget to an entire 1%.
Yeah, an entire penny per dollar.
If we did that, it would be incredible.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mika, if the people listening aren't more excited about these things after hearing you talk about them, I don't think they have a pulse. I am so happy that you joined me on the podcast. I had such a great time. And before you go, will you let everybody know how they can, you know, see your work? You know, they can go to
yes.
IO9, where in social media, all that good stuff.
So I run space.io9.com is my happy little home of all physical sciences. I've kind of expanded where I went, oh, Earth is in space and plants are on Earth and sharks swim in the ocean. So it's a very broad definition of space. I sometimes write on IO9 and Gizmodo on their main pages as well, and then other various spots around the interwebs. I'm on Twitter as Mika McKinnon, MikaMckinnon. And that's it, I think.
Great. Well, Mika, thank you so much. I learned a ton from talking to you. I know a lot of my listeners did too. Get ready to get some tweets. I know they'll be sent
Fantastic.
Your way.
Yes. I love playing Ask a Scientist. As long as it's not Stump a Scientist, then it's a little harder. Then you just have to ask me about squishy things. And I'm like, I don't know.
Something tells you that Mika just invited you guys to Ask a Scientist. So yeah, be ready for that. And everybody who has tuned in week after week, I thank you for joining me. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.